This is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we begin our politics and government roundtable this week with two departures from the Prisoner Review Board. That's the Illinois government panel that makes decisions about when people should be released from Illinois prisons and under what conditions. A man is accused of stabbing his pregnant ex-girlfriend and killing her 11-year-old son just a day after he was released from state custody. A release that happened because members of the Prisoner Review Board voted to release him. On Monday, the chairman of the board and one other member resigned from their posts. Jeremy Gorner has been following the story for the Chicago Tribune. Jeremy, welcome back to the show. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Brian.
Crisetti Brand is the man accused of killing 11-year-old Jaden Perkins, stabbing Jaden's mother. What was his story before this alleged attack?
So Crisetti Brand has a history of domestic violence in his criminal record. He was paroled in October in connection with a 2015 case. It was a home invasion. Separate from that, he had basically been involved in several cases leading up to the fatal stabbing of Jaden. Jaden's mother dated at one time. This is more than 15 years ago, and there had been several cases against Crisetti brought forth by Jaden's mother, where she had alleged and documented abuse from Mr. Brand in court records through orders of protection and so on and so forth. A couple of different instances going back to 2006. But he was paroled in October in a separate case. And, at that time, basically, so that happens in October. And then in late January of this year, he contacts Jaden's mother, and she ended up getting it. She had gotten an emergency order of protection against Mr. Brand. I believe she had an order of protection from years back against him at that point as well, because he had showed up to her home on Chicago's northwest side, or on Chicago's north side, rather, Brian.
Yeah.
So then what happens is that state officials are notified, parole authorities are notified, and he goes back into state custody. Then on February 26th, he had a parole revocation hearing, alleging that he had violated certain terms of parole, which would have included contacting, Jaden's mother, who he was apparently not allowed to contact. And at that point, during the hearing on February 26th, Brand and his lawyer had successfully argued, they were saying that Brand was not at the residence, as what was alleged. And that GPS data, which is what parolees are required, parolees are generally tracked for GPS data, did not show that he was at the home. And so based on there was a lack of preponderance of evidence to basically conclude by this three-member panel of the parole board, of the Prisoner Review Board, that he had committed those violations. But
so let me recap this and see if correct me if I'm wrong on any of this. He's in prison for a separate thing. He's paroled last year. His ex-partner alleges that he was threatening again. He's retaken back into custody. But when there's finally a hearing on this re-custody, they decide not enough evidence. He's set free. The next day, he allegedly attacks her and kills her son. What do we?
That's correct.
Yeah. So what has come out about the thinking of the board? The board was already under scrutiny. You and I have talked about that on the program before. Have people on the board acknowledged wrongdoing, or do we just have these resignations sort of speaking for themselves?
We have these resignations that were announced by the governor. The governor in a statement, in announcing the resignation of Leanne Miller, who led this three-person panel. She was a Pritzker appointee, appointed the board in 2021. He had basically said in his statement that, that obviously the board came to a conclusion that they should not have come to. He didn't really get into great deal about that in announcing her resignation. But that's pretty much all we've seen is the statement from the governor, pretty much acknowledging that he should not have been released, and that she had made the correct decision to resign. And then hours later, what we saw is that Don Shelton, longtime member of the Prison Review Board, who became the chair of the board last year, he resigned as well. There was no reason given there by the governor for his resignation. Shelton, he did lead this panel. And Shelton, of course, he's had a reputation being very well respected, very fair as head of the board. He's got a lot of experience. He was appointed by Pat Quinn in 2012. So he resigned after 12 years on the board.
Yeah, I will say I've seen him make some very tough decisions over the years, too. I know him slightly. He was friends with a former colleague of mine. Just for full disclosure's sake, they were not close or anything like that by any stretch. But just about less than a minute remaining in our time together. What are you watching for next here? I know there's been a lot of controversy. What is there an appetite for changing the Prisoner Review Board legislatively or something?
Well, that was the thing, is that the governor has kind of hinted that there could be some legislative changes if necessary. I mean, clearly, he wants to see better communication between the Prisoner Review Board and the Illinois Department of Corrections and law enforcement agencies. And this could also, we could possibly see some reforms in the way that PRB members hear domestic violence cases, which, has been argued should be treated from other cases. For parolees. So we could see some reforms in that area. The way it stands right now, mm-hmm. there's the PRB is now down to 11 members. The maximum they could have is 15. And so another thing to look out for is,
appointments and whether that'll come along. Yeah.
Who's Pritzker going to appoint? And are there going to be people who are a little shy to apply for this job? It's definitely a very difficult job. And of course,
All right. Jeremy Gorner with the Chicago Tribune. Thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Brian.
This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're going to shift gears now to talk about national politics. With us to talk about that, as always, is Linda Kenyon, who covers the Congress for Illinois Public Media. Linda, welcome back. Good to talk with you again.
Well, it's always good to be back here, Brian. Thank you.
So we finally have closure on the months-long saga of the potential government shutdowns you and I have talked about endlessly, it seems, over the past, 6 months now on this program. The Senate passed the last spending bills for the year shortly after midnight on Saturday. President Biden signed the legislation later that day. It has bipartisan votes in both the Senate and the House. We'll get back to that in a moment, though. But first, we'll just take us through what is in this budget deal.
This is a major funding bill. This is half of the government funding agencies. The other half of the government agencies that required funding were passed, was passed on March 8th. And so that left another six agencies and departments without funding for fiscal 2024. So this bill, a minibus, which is, a conglomeration of six bills as opposed to 12, they will cover the defense, financial services and general government, homeland security, departments of labor, health and human services, education, the legislative branch, and there is foreign operations, Department of State, an awful lot of government money. In fact, this second minibus, following the one that passed on March 8th, was a real heavy lift because the majority of government funding for various agencies and departments, the biggest funding agencies, were included in this bill.
We in the media get all kinds of news releases from government officials. One of them this week was from Senators Durbin and Duckworth of Illinois, sort of proudly proclaiming all the money they secured for our home state here. I'm just going to rattle off a couple of these. There's a photographic digitization initiative in Bloomington. The McLean County Historical Society is getting a little more than $500,000 to digitize photographic negatives of the Pantograph newspaper. There's an emergency operations center in Macomb, $1.5 million. dollars there, flood mitigation here, a new Bachelor of Nursing program in Jacksonville. I mean, we could spend the next 20 minutes reading all these things off. What I want to ask you about is, how have you seen the discussion around bringing money back home change over time in the Congress, right? You still see a lot of Democrats happily claiming credit for this. There's been more of a divide on whether to do this sort of thing among Republicans, right?
Well, Republicans have long decried what they call pork barrel spending. Of course, every district wants to bring home the bacon, which is why we're calling it pork barrel spending. But if you don't bring home the bacon, then you're not exactly doing what you promised your constituents that you would do when you were elected in the first place. And that is to help your particular district with the monies that are necessary to affect various projects or programs in your state or in your district. So while everybody claims it's pork barrel spending, everybody wants their particular pork barrel spending. Another term for it is earmarks. And there was a time in Congress, not in the very too distant past, where members of Congress said there will be no more earmarking. Well, that didn't last very long. And now they're back to earmarking or pork barrel spending.
You know, I like to think that earmarking is the grease that makes our politics work. But you do now have this generation of Congress people, mostly Republicans. I think probably all Republicans. I shouldn't say that, but mostly Republicans that seem to even just reject the idea that. So they say, well, you know what? I'm not going to bring stuff home for my district. That seems, I don't know, maybe it's not new. Maybe I'm being naive here, but you've had this turn away from earmarks. Now there's this turn back. And I don't know, it seems like we're still feeling our way forward.
Yeah, but the reality is that when a member goes to serve their state or their district, they go to Congress in order to serve their constituents. It's all about that. And if they're not serving their constituents, then they're not going to get reelected. And serving their constituents involves, in many cases, and if not, if we dare to say in the majority of cases, involves bringing some money into your district so that you can serve your constituents. It's a circular argument. And if you end up not doing that, you're not going to get reelected.
Yeah. Although I guess what I see is there are people now who seems more than serving their constituents, it's about media appearances and owning the other side and doing that sort of thing. And on that note, perhaps we now have another one of these motions to vacate the chair. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia filed, but did not actually call up a motion to oust Speaker Johnson from his post. She described it as more of a warning than a pink slip. I do not wish to inflict pain on our conference and throw the House into chaos, she said. This did fail the previous speaker. What makes this time different?
Well, this time, there aren't a lot of Republicans who are necessarily going to align themselves with this effort, this motion to vacate. The last motion to vacate, which ousted the previous House Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, was brought on by House conservatives, most specifically the House Freedom Caucus, because they were very upset with him over a number of issues, not the least of which was turning to the Democratic side of the aisle to pass legislation, including funding measures. So what's happened? What is the timing here? Well, Marjorie Taylor Greene filed her notice that she will move ahead with the motion to vacate after the House passed the government funding bill. And that doesn't sit well with her. Now, a lot of Republicans are saying she saved us the embarrassment, not she, but the House saved us the embarrassment of another prolonged charade or drama or whatever, however you wish to describe it, on the House floor, where the House was rudderless because it had no speaker, because they couldn't find a speaker who would take the job or who could get enough votes to be elected to that job. So government was paralyzed, and it came back looking very, very bad for the Republicans, and they don't wish to repeat that this time. So that's one of the reasons why Marjorie Taylor Greene may not have a lot of Republicans on her side this time.
And an increasing number of Republicans are guaranteeing that they are not going to have to repeat that sort of thing if it does come to pass again, because they are heading for the exits. And the latest one of these was Representative Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin. He was seen as a rising figure in the party. He had wanted this special committee on China, had it handed to him, and he is not just announced he's not running for re-election, which he had already done, but now he says he's out the door in mid-April. The seat is apparently going to be empty until the general election. Can you remember a time when there were this many people heading for the exits? And what are the consequences of that for the majority?
I cannot remember a time when there were so many members heading for the exits. You might expect that the minority party in the respective House or Senate might be the ones who were the most disillusioned and would want to leave. But what we're seeing is an exodus from members of the majority party, the Republicans in the House, highly unusual. And with this latest resignation, it will leave Republicans with a slimmer majority than they already have, making it near impossible to pass their conservative agenda items or to pass pretty much anything without some buy-in from Democrats. And as this would be, once again, one of the major things that has upset Marjorie Taylor Greene with the previous speaker, which was his need to reach across the aisle to pass anything. And now we can see that that's going to be needed even more. With the new majority in the House, Republicans will have 217 to 213. That means they cannot afford to lose more than one vote if something must be done on a party line vote. That means they're going to have to turn to Democrats to get some of their votes on various issues, on various legislation. And Speaker Mike Johnson knows that that's how it's going to have to be, that he is going to work with Democrats. He must do so in order to pass practically anything.
May you live in interesting times indeed. Linda Kenyon covers Washington politics and our congressional delegation for Illinois Public Media. Good to talk with you again. Happy Friday.
Well, thank you, and happy Friday to you.
More to come after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.